Hello and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, episode 112. I am your host, The Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my co-host and nemesis, Pete Michaud.
Good to be here, Chris.
I wish I could say it was good to have you, but as your nemesis, I'm inclined to disagree. Oh boy, that was really mean. Anyway, we are back once again to talk about the latest goings-on in the world of Nintendo. As I mentioned last week, there's been a whole bunch of games that came out recently, and it's pretty much impossible for us to cover them all, but we're going to try to catch up discussing a few more new releases this week. We've also got a little bit of news to discuss. We've got some listener letters, and then we've got this week's big topic, which is going to be the best and worst NES peripherals.
Mm-hmm.
And to kick things off, let's start by discussing a recent release on the Nintendo Switch, Tiny Barbarian DX.
I'm super curious about this one. What'd you think, Chris?
Well, I'm liking this game so far. For those unfamiliar with it, it is an action platformer that is heavily inspired by barbarian literature, such as Conan the Barbarian, and you get to hack and slash your way through five chapters of action. There's lots of hacking up enemies with a sword. Also, you can do moves like a wrestling elbow drop and then a muscle flex pose that defeats enemies. So you can tell it's not exactly very serious. And even though you're hacking and slashing up enemies, it's not gory or anything like that. It's very, very cute.
Yeah. Sounds like they're playing to your sensibilities.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. So there's lots of emphasis on action, lots of emphasis on platforming. So in addition to just hacking up enemies, you're doing a lot of climbing on chains and swinging hand over hand, a monkey bar style from vines attached to the ceiling. And that's in addition to traditional precarious jumps and the occasional opportunity to ride mounts such as a giant bee or a saber-toothed cat. And so far, I'm finding that the action is really, really well done. Slashing up enemies and executing simple combos is really satisfying. And, you know, sort of like Shovel Knight, this kind of feels like a lost classic retro game. Like this really could have been something that was in the arcades in the early 90s or maybe on the Sega Genesis.
Very cool.
Yeah, it is. And it's very old school in a lot of ways. It has this really cool pixel art. I mean, it's called Tiny Barbarian because he is just a few pixels high on the screen, but it works really, really well. Oh, and also, he kind of looks like he has this burly old beard. And just looking at the sprite, you might think that's the case. It's actually a pelt, but, you know, you can't really tell. You can pretend it's like a massive beard, and I think you'd like it even more, Pete. It's also got a great retro soundtrack, and then like a lot of, you know, classic action platforming games, there's just stuff hidden all over the place, you know, hidden gems in the walls that get you bonus points. Yes, the game actually has a score, like, you know, an old school action game.
Nice.
Oh, and, you know, there's meat, there's roasts just hiding in the wall, a la Castlevania
right.
And many other classic games.
I mean, who wouldn't eat a roast just hiding in the wall?
I know we certainly would. And there's just lots of little cool, you know, I don't know if they're really homages to classic games, but they certainly remind me of a lot of classic games. Like there's a
sure.
Golden Axe style gnome who runs around and you can beat him up to steal his treasure and
perfect.
Get meat from him. And there's like a Ghosts and Goblins style map screen between the levels. So that stuff's in there, but it doesn't really, you know, beat you over the head with it that it's being an homage. It's all very well done and very well implemented. Also, the game is pretty darn hard. It is quite challenging from what I've played, but the one difference between this and other, you know, real, you know, classic old school games is that you do have infinite lives. So you can just try again, but you're thrown back to the beginning of the area you've entered. So, you know, persistence pays off. You can keep trying, but man, there are some parts that are still really, really rough. You know, there's some really tough platforming and, you know, some of the bosses I'd get to them and it'd be like, oh man, what the heck do I do? And, you know, this guy would just wipe me out before I could, you know, barely inflict any damage. But then I'd try again and I'd, you know, start to learn the pattern and then I'd figure out the pattern and then eventually I'd be able to take him out. Like, okay, now I know what I'm doing.
Right.
So again, very satisfying.
Cool. Now, is there a reason why he's a tiny barbarian?
Well, he's not like, you know, a tiny barbarian in the game compared to the other enemies. Everybody's tiny in the game. So, no, he's not like a shrunken barbarian or something like that. Just, you know, everybody happens to be tiny because it's, you know, classic style action.
Yeah, he comes from a tiny village.
That's really the only reason.
Gotcha.
You know, the gnomes you fight, much tinier.
Mm.
Snakes, also tinier. It's really cool how the narrative unfolds in the game, too. Like, there's no real obvious story or, you know, cutscenes like in Ninja Gaiden or anything like that, but it's all unspoken and presented in a really nifty way. Like, you start the game in the wilderness, and then you sort of get to this city with a temple in it, and you see this temple with a snake motif. Of course, all the while you're hacking up, you know, the bad guys are attacking you. And then, you know, you encounter these sorcerers, and they start turning into snakes. And then there's this boss with a giant snake statue there. And, you know, eventually you're fighting, like, this gigantic screen-filling snake god. So, obviously, the whole plot of this first act is that, you know, you're battling some evil snake cult. But there's really no explicit telling of the story. And I kind of like that old-school type of storytelling. I mean, a lot of NES games were that same way.
Yeah.
And it works pretty well.
Right, like Adventure Island, there's really no story. You just kind of jump in and progress through levels. That's kind of it.
Yeah, I suppose so. Although this, as opposed to Adventure Island, I think it really does tell a really compelling, interesting story just through its backgrounds and the settings and the things that you go through and do. Whereas, like Adventure Island, I'm not sure it did that. It's kind of funny that you mention Adventure Island, though, because the box art for this game on the physical release was done by Susumu Matsushita, who I think also did some of the artwork for Adventure Island and is also, you know, probably best known for doing the covers of Famitsu magazine. So that's another pretty neat touch to this game. In fact, just the whole physical release is really, really nice. It comes with a absolutely glorious full-color manual, really in-depth and old-school to the max. Also comes with a character keychain and, like, this little Tiny Barbarian-branded pouch. I'm not really sure what it's for, like, you know, keep your marbles in it or something. But hey, it's a nice freebie.
Have you lost yours?
Well, not anymore. I got a pouch to keep them in. And it's also got a reversible cover. So one side has the Susumu Matsushita art, and then the other side has alternate artwork that I believe is drawn by the main developer of the game. So yeah, I'm really, really enjoying the game so far. My only complaint really is that it's just sometimes pretty brutal. And, you know, some of the times that I died, I just felt like, oh, man, that was so cheap. Like, you know, sometimes I couldn't tell if there was a pit below me or spikes or if there was actually a floor I could jump down to. But that's pretty rare. Most of the time when I would die, I'd be like, okay, well, I know exactly what got me there.
Cool.
But it can still be pretty tough despite the infinite lives. And I feel like I'm really getting my money's worth. This is a $30 game, but the first act took me a couple hours to play through. And I feel like, boy, if that had been the entire game and I paid like, you know, $10 for it, that probably would have been worth it. So that's just one act out of the five. And so I think that I'll probably be very satisfied with the overall package unless it just gets so hard that I chuck my Switch out the window and then I'm like, well, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, that's cool. I think for me, the $30 price point is putting me off just a little bit. I don't think it's unreasonable, but I do think that the game sort of has to be proven that it's good before I will pick it up. Sounds like you like it a lot, though. So
yeah, I definitely do so far. I'm only partway into the second chapter, so my opinion is subject to change. But so far, it's totally worth the money, especially if you get the physical release with all the extra goodies.
Cool. Yeah, worth checking out, sounds like.
Yep, it's very neat.
And tiny.
All right, on to the other game I've been playing over the last few days, Stardew Valley, also on the Nintendo Switch.
Nice. How's that going?
It's going pretty well so far. This is a game that I've been waiting for a long, long time. I had been anticipating it for, you know, months, ever since it was first announced to be coming to Switch, just because I had heard so much good stuff about it on other systems. And so I just, you know, really couldn't wait to get into this.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good buzz for this game.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, me too. I've heard just tons and tons of good things about this old-school style farming sim. And it is very, very charming. It has a great old-school 16-bit look. It's got some very soothing music. And it takes a lot of cues from other games in the same genre, like Harvest Moon and Story of Seasons. So you're planting and tending to crops, you're raising livestock, you're mining for materials, chopping down trees and foraging for plants. And then you use what you find to upgrade your farm and earn new stuff and create new furniture and things of that nature. And of course, there are lots of NPCs in the nearby village to interact with and maintain relationships with as well.
Sounds just like a normal day in your life.
Pretty much, just with more cows.
Well, here's the question everybody wants to know, Chris. Do you have a wife yet?
Not yet, no.
No.
I have, you know, been playing, you know, several hours into the game, but that's not nearly far enough to find a spouse.
Same with real life.
I suppose that's true. So far, the biggest change compared to similar games is that when you go exploring in the mine, there are enemies to fight. And you can get equipped with a sword, you can get equipped with other items that boost your defense. And so, in that sense, it's not really breaking new ground, since there was also, you know, Rune Factory, which combined farming and real-time combat also. But it certainly does stand out from your average farming sim because of that.
Yeah.
Another thing that's really interesting about it is there's lots of bizarre story stuff happening. Like, there's some overarching plot about a big corporation that's kind of ruining the traditional way of life and making people miserable. And there's some mystery about, like, maybe monsters are living in the sewers. And then there's a wizard in a tower nearby. So it's probably safe to say it is more quirky and more contemporary than similar games of this type.
Hmm. Yeah, I kind of like that.
Still, despite that, the game really hasn't grabbed me like I was expecting. Like, I just heard, you know, so many good things. I was like, okay, this is totally going to blow everything else out of the water. It's totally going to reinvent the farming game genre. And so far, that just hasn't happened. Now, maybe that's because I'm only like 5 hours in. Maybe there's still more to come. And, you know, the way these games unfold is you have to just play through several weeks or months, and then you wake up in the morning and suddenly someone new is at the door and something new happens. So, I don't know. That can always happen in a game of this type. So, maybe there's, you know, big shocking stuff yet to come. But so far, I have not really encountered it. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's pretty good, but I'm just not blown away like I was expecting to be. Plus, I don't believe there are any capybaras like there were in Story of Seasons, Trio of Towns, so that's kind of a bummer.
Chris, I feel like you're opening yourself to some serious hate mail by hating on this game. There's a lot of Stardew Valley lovers out there, I know that.
Dude, I'm not hating on it. I like it. It's just, after everything I'd heard, I was kind of expecting it to be some kind of revelation for the genre, and that just hasn't happened yet. On top of that, there are definitely some issues with this version that Switch owners might want to keep in mind. Like, there's actually a pretty gnarly audio glitch in the game that just makes staticky audio sort of appear at random, and that just sticks around, and it just keeps playing along with the music.
That's not good.
No, it's not. You can try to switch your audio to mono to try to fix it, and that did work for me for a while, but then after that it came back. It did make it better, but it didn't eliminate it entirely, and it's kind of driving me nuts, so I'm really hoping that there is a patch in the works to fix that, because it's just not good. Also, the game takes a really long time to save, and when you first boot it up, to load initially as well. Like, I haven't had wait times this bad since, like, the Sega CD era.
Wow. That's saying something.
It's fairly ridiculous. Yeah, I don't know what's going on. But yeah, those are definitely some issues it has on the technical side. I'd love to see that fixed, because I intend to keep playing and discover if there's more to Stardew Valley than initially meets the eye, but this audio glitch especially makes it hard to fully enjoy. I mean, beyond that, I want to say it is a really fun, really relaxing game, and I think if you are already into games like Harvest Moon and Story of Seasons, you will probably love it. But yeah, I would strongly advise waiting for a patch.
That's crazy. You don't hear a lot of audio bugs. No pun intended.
Yeah. I was going to say, no, you only hear the audio bugs.
So I made a joke about you finding a wife earlier. Is there anyone you have your eye on so far?
No, not yet. I've been so busy with my pickaxe and my hoe that I really haven't had a chance to mingle with the NPCs too much just yet.
Well, those ladies should consider themselves lucky that they're all still viable options for you, huh?
Yes, indeed. And it turns out that it's not just the ladies. You can actually be in a same-sex relationship if you want to in this game and have a same-sex marriage with the dudes. I'm probably not going to do that, but it is in there as an option, I understand.
Well, how forward-thinking.
Yeah, and I should mention, I'm playing as a male character. You can also choose to play as a female character, in which case you also have the option to date or marry members of either gender as well.
That's cool.
But again, before I do any of that, I definitely want to have that audio fixed. Hopefully, it is in the works. So moving on from that and onto some other exciting indie-related news, I also recently picked up the Shovel Knight Official Design Works art book.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty darn neat. This is a very extensive 184-page art book from the folks at Udon Entertainment, and it is just jam-packed with Shovel Knight goodness. It does, of course, have all the key illustrations and art for pretty much every character, boss, enemy, NPC, armor, and item in the game. Pretty much official illustrations of everything. And then there's tons of behind-the-scenes stuff, like concept art for, you know, all that very same stuff, just, you know, loads and loads of it. It is very, very thorough. Plus, on top of that, it has sprites, so you get to see, like, all the detailed animations for every character in the game. All the backgrounds from the actual in-game assets are in there. And then there's also fan art and tribute art from professional artists. Hmm. So, it is just a wealth of content in this book.
A virtual treasure trove?
Yes. Yes, it is. You could indeed say that. It does cover the original Shovel Knight, as well as Plague of Shadows, so Spectre of Torment is not in there.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it is, you know, just jam-packed with stuff. It's also got tons of designer notes and commentary, and then 8 solid pages of interviews. So, if you are a big Shovel Knight fan, or have a Shovel Knight fan in your life, this would make an excellent gift. I definitely recommend it from what I've looked at so far.
Yeah, it's very cool looking. I'm just kind of looking through some of the images of it right now. It looks like it would be quite a piece to have.
Yeah, it seems pretty excellent. I mean, I've only flipped through it and read a few things so far. But I look forward to when I get to sit down and, you know, go through it with a fine-toothed comb.
Very cool. I would like to dig into it myself.
Ha, ha, ha. I see what you did there. The book is out now. The retail price is $40. But if you go onto Amazon, you can pick it up for about $25.
Hey, Chris, I got a piece of news for you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Have you heard that they officially announced the Doom release date for Switch?
I have seen a date floating around. I don't think I realized that it hadn't been announced previously. So when's it out? When is it due?
Oh, boy. It's actually going to be out on November 10th, it sounds like.
Oh, all right.
Which is kind of bizarre when you think about it, because Skyrim comes out November 17th. And you would think they've had more time with Skyrim, but perhaps not.
Yeah, you would think that both being Bethesda releases, they'd space those out a bit more. But still, that's pretty cool. That's good to know. It's going to be available for Switch players in less than a month.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Maybe they want Skyrim to be the sort of like Thanksgiving pickup must-have when you're on your 3 to 6 hour flights to home or wherever you're going for the holidays.
Maybe. Or maybe it's as simple as the fact that Nintendo is publishing Skyrim while Bethesda itself is publishing Doom. Regardless, I'd like to think there's enough room on the Switch for 2 M-rated AAA titles, even if they are released only a week apart.
Yeah, I'm considering picking up both of these, actually.
Well, cool. I hope you do. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
All right.
All right, let's move along and answer some listener mail. This first one comes from Dark Shuey via Twitter. And he writes, I have a question for the experts. What game type do you think the Switch will be most known for? RPGs, platformers, shooters, or what?
Did he just call us experts?
He did.
Wow. Thanks, Shuey.
Do you have an answer for him?
Oh, man. That's a tough one, but I kind of have a cop-out answer.
I've got an answer for you. Neo Geo games.
Oh, you got jokes, Hoffman. Jokes.
Making like a third of the library.
Yeah, that's very true.
But seriously, though, beyond that, it's really hard to say. I mean, we're so early in the system's life cycle.
Yeah.
I think it'd be fair to say indie games can be known for a lot of indie games. It's already proven to be a great home for indie games.
Yep.
Also, I think, obviously, it's a great place for multiplayer and co-op games since, you know, with the 2 built-in controllers, that's something that a lot of developers have been emphasizing.
Yeah, that's true.
But beyond that, you know, I really hope it's not known for anything in particular. I'd like it to be known for diversity, so that's my hope.
Yeah.
What about you? Sorry for interrupting earlier.
No. I actually think that you're spot on with indie games. That was kind of going to be mine. But I actually have one other. I think that the Switch, and maybe I'm just making this up, but I have a feeling that Nintendo is sort of back to the like AAA title belief that you need to have these games that are really, you know, over the top blockbusters. They kind of got away from that during the Wii and Wii U era. Maybe not so much, but certainly more than, you know, in the past. It felt like they did a lot more quantity, even though the quality was good too. They just weren't quite the same level of like a Breath of the Wild, let's say. And I think the Switch is a little bit more, you know, I think they understand the importance of the core gamer.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And I think that they're trying to make these blockbuster, like, you know, 40-hour plus adventures. So we'll see if that continues after Odyssey.
Well, I don't think I totally agree, but they're certainly more core focused now as opposed to the casual focus of the Wii and the early Wii U years. And if they're able to come in with AAA games and the indie guys keep doing their thing, that could be quite a legacy for Switch.
Yeah, all I know is I don't have time to play any of this.
It is hard. It is definitely hard. Okay, the next letter comes from Tyler F., and he writes, during your recent SNES Classic Edition episode, you complained about how bland the borders were. I disagree. I use the retro glowing screen border to simulate a CRT TV that's on in the dark. If you pay attention during gameplay, the border glow changes colors to reflect the colors that are on the screen. Also, I emailed you a few weeks ago complaining about how I wasn't able to secure an SNES Classic pre-order. I'm happy to report I was able to get an SNES Classic, so there are definitely more in stock than there were NES Classics last year.
Cool.
Responding to that, A, I'm really glad that he was able to get a system.
Yeah, no kidding.
B, I'm really glad that some people like those borders that are included there with the Super NES Classic. To be honest, I hadn't noticed what he was saying about that frame. It's the second one from the left if you're going into the Super NES menu and changing the borders. But yeah, it actually does change colors based on what's happening on screen. That's definitely a cool touch.
That's cool. I'm going to have to check that one out. I wanted the record to show, though, that you were the one who kind of complained about the dull borders. I kind of liked them.
Well, I'm sticking to that. you know, I'm using the faux wood frame with the Super Famicom logo on it. And, you know, it's all right. But I still think they really missed a trick. I mean, you know, having a wood frame or some speakers, you know, those are okay. But those could kind of be on anything. You know, it could be on an Xbox border for anything. You know, they could have had, you know, a Mario-themed frame or a Zelda-themed frame or a Kirby-themed frame. And all of those I thought would be really cool and something that nobody else could do. So when I say that they're kind of bland or generic, that's what I mean. Just not very Nintendo-y.
Heck, they could have had a Power Pros-themed frame, really.
Yeah, would have given them that one for a very, very small fee. Okay, our last letter comes from listener Brian Booth, and he writes, I'm glad to say that after visiting 4 Walmarts on the night of the 28th and finding them already sold out of Super NES Classics, I decided on a whim to stop by Target an hour before it opened. I was 18th in line, they had 56, so my only problem was having to wait until I got back home that night to play my new old games. Regarding your rankings on your Super NES Classic episode, I'll say that your top 4 are spot on, and I can't argue with most of the list except to say I put both Earthbound and Yoshi's Island much higher. I feel like other than the top 4, the rankings of most games in the lineup are mostly a matter of taste. Except Super Ghouls and Ghosts, that one belongs right where it is on your list, except maybe a little lower.
Wow.
The games I'd like to add most were intermingled with yours, but I'll add a few honorable mentions. Axlay, The Secret of Evermore, Zombies Ate My Neighbors, Mega Man 7, and The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse.
Hmm.
Also, I liked your pro tip about the classic controller and the use of the home button to get back to the menu screen. Here's another pro tip. You can plug the SNES Classic controller into a Wii remote and use it to play Virtual Console titles on both the Wii and the Wii U.
Sweet. That's a big letter.
And responding to that, specifically to you know, the honorable mention games he would add to the list, I totally agree with a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
Axlay is definitely a personal favorite of mine. Mega Man 7 is great. Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse, that's another one of my Super NES favorites. If I could add, you know, another 10 more to the system, most of those would probably be on there. Axlay definitely would be. You know, maybe not Mega Man 7 because we got Mega Man X, and so I'm not so worried about getting another Mega Man game. But those are all still pretty great games.
Shout out to Zombies Ate My Neighbors, by the way.
Yeah, totally. And regarding what he was saying about the Super NES Classic controller, indeed, you can plug it into a Wii remote and then use it to play on Wii or Wii U Virtual Console, just like you could with the NES Classic controller from last year. But this one is sort of, you know, really special to me because in Japan, Club Nintendo actually released a Super Famicom controller for the Wii that was supposed to be used for just this purpose. And it was awesome, and it never came out here in the US. And, you know, I really, really was hoping that it would. And I did manage to get one of those Super Famicom controllers over in Japan, but I wanted everyone to be able to get one, and I wanted to get one in Super NES Purple. But, you know, Club Nintendo here was just awful, so it didn't happen.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But yeah, now we finally do get that essentially the same thing all these years later, and it's totally awesome. So, yes, that is a great thing about these controllers that came with that system. Absolutely.
You know, my big takeaway from this letter? The poor bastard had to go to 4 Walmarts. I'm so sorry. No one should have to go to 4 Walmarts on the same night. Not on my watch.
You make a very good point, but, you know, you do what you gotta do when the Super NES Classic is involved. Mm-hmm. All right, that takes care of this week's letters, so let's take an intermission, and then we come back, we'll discuss this week's big topic, which is the best and worst NES peripherals. All right, we are back and we are ready to discuss this week's big topic, which is the best and worst NES peripherals. Mm. You know, Pete, as we are recording this, we are experiencing an anniversary. It is the anniversary of the NES's original release in North America this week. It will be turning 32 years old.
Wow.
Of course, we've talked tons about, you know, various NES games and things of that nature. So I thought, hey, to celebrate this year, let's do something a little different. Let's talk about some of the peripherals that helped make that system so memorable.
Yeah, there were a lot of them.
Yeah, there was some good stuff. There was some bad stuff. And so we're going to talk about all of it right here with our best and worst NES peripherals discussion.
Sweet.
And I think probably the best place to start would be one of the most recognizable, most well-known, most popular peripherals for the system, the NES Advantage joystick.
Oh yeah, man, what a whopper.
Now, Pete, I didn't actually own an NES Advantage, so why don't you tell us about, you know, why this was such a great and popular joystick for the NES?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of things going for it. First off, it was massive. It was the size of a, you know, a small pizza box. Yeah,
it was pretty big.
It was almost really the size of the NES, I think, if you put it on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, it didn't have any, like, outlandish buttons beyond its, you know, the typical NES A, B, and control pad. But it did do away with the control pad, had a joystick.
Yeah, so it brought that sort of, you know, arcade experience home. And it was pretty substantial, too. It didn't feel cheap. It felt very nice and hefty.
Yeah, and it really, for all intents and purposes, kind of was the first, like, home version of an arcade stick. I can't really think of another version of that before. I mean, like Atari and things like that were, there was nothing quite on this scale. This thing was, you know, a beast, really.
Yep, it was pretty large.
Now, a couple of the functions that really kind of set it apart was that, well, first off, you could actually plug it into both Player 1 and Player 2 ports on your NES.
Yes, that's right. And then there was a switch on the Advantage, so you could change between Player 1 and Player 2 for alternating games.
Right, which is so bizarre when you think about that, but, you know, it kind of makes sense. You just swap the controller back and forth, or maybe maybe just swap the kid, since the controller is probably harder to move. And then, of course, you also had, you know, a turbo on-off setting.
Yes.
So you could, like, you could literally toggle the button whether you have turbo on, turbo off, and then the revolutionary thing was the actual ability to set the amount of turbo. So
yeah, there was a knob, so it was variable, right?
Yeah, so like depending on the game, you know, some games if you hit the button too fast, it wouldn't even register as it being a turbo. And when I say turbo, for those of you that don't know, it basically just meant that you were hitting the button repeatedly without hitting the button repeatedly.
Yeah, rapid fire, built-in yeah. rapid fire.
So when you hold down the B button, it would just continually hit the B button at set intervals. And there was a knob that let you adjust that interval duration. So, you know, for a game like, I don't know.
Contra?
Me, yeah, Contra, for example. Rather
that would
than
wear out your damn finger just mashing the shot button constantly. So yeah, it was really helpful for games like that.
And then you could dial that turbo in, so it really, you know, you were spamming the enemy as much as possible. So, you know, it was really as close to cheating as you kind of could get, you know, right out of the box from Nintendo.
Well, it saved a lot of wear and tear on people's fingers, you know. If it weren't for Turbo Fire, you know, we'd probably all have, you know, some sort of, you know, degenerative hand disease or something all these years later.
It's true. Now, the other last feature that I should call out is the slow motion button. It actually literally yes. just said slow.
Okay.
Which is kind of funny. And what that did was it it's almost like, how did they have a slow motion option on these old consoles? Well, they didn't really. They actually
cheated, okay?
Yeah, all they did was basically just like Turbo, instead of Turbo A and B, it's Turbo on the start button.
Right.
And what that did was, is in a lot
not
of games,
Turbo, but it was like an automatic, it was auto fire on the start button. You didn't have to press the start button, it would just kick in automatically.
Right.
And so it would just pause and unpause your game really, really fast. Which, you know, if you're playing a game that had a clean pause that, you know, paused, you know, very quickly, and it was something like Contra, then it actually did have a slow motion effect. And so for a game where you're trying to dodge bullets and something like that, or Gradius or other shooting type games, it could come in really, really useful.
Right. Now, it didn't work with a lot of games that had no pause menu, or maybe the menu was like a little more elaborate. For example,
yes.
Punch-Out had no pause menu, so that was kind of useless.
Right, right.
And then, of course, Zelda brings up a menu, and there's this huge animation. So about 2 seconds into using that, you would never want to try it again.
Right.
Or then the other weird part would be like if a game had like a random sound associated with the pause menu, you'd actually hear this.
Yep.
Which is also not very fun.
Which a lot of the Konami games I was just mentioning did.
Yeah, exactly. So it wasn't without its problems, but it still actually came in, I guess.
And also made the music, of course, you know, all stutter and slow-mo and stuff. But
right.
I mean, still, it was a cool feature to be able to have, even if it didn't work with everything. So
kind of bonkers that it was in a first-party, you know, Nintendo accessory. But, you know, it was a different time and different place, so.
Yeah, it was still a great piece of hardware, the funkiness of the slow motion button notwithstanding.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, if maybe having a big joystick like that was a little bit too bulky for you, the other excellent peripheral on the NES was to get something a little smaller and go with the NES Max.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chris, did you own one of those?
I owned two of them.
Oh, nice. Spoiled much?
Well, the second one I ended up getting years and years later after my first one had been worn into the ground. I actually ordered it straight from Nintendo, like as the NES was being phased out. And I'm like, you know what? I know I'm going to want another one of these years down the road. And so, you know, I ordered it for, you know, through the mail for like, you know, half the retail cost because they were trying to clear them out.
Man.
And I'm really glad I did because it's a really, really great controller that, you know, just, you know, fits into the palm of your hand just as well as the regular NES controller does. And it might not have had the arcade style joystick. It might not have had slow mo. It might not have had variable turbo fire, but it did have its own separate turbo fire buttons for both the A button and the B button. Whereas on the Advantage, you had to turn the turbo on and off. On this, you actually had four separate buttons, so you could switch back and forth between them, you know, just on the fly, depending on what you needed. And that was super duper useful.
Yeah, this one actually was my favorite controller
oh, wow.
edition accessory for the NES, I think.
Wow, we actually agree on something. This is horrifying and shocking.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you in the sense that, yeah, it was great to have that option to be able to use Turbo when you needed it and not when you didn't. A lot of games, you know, there are times where you want to fire like mad, and then there's other times where you want to be a little bit more precise. So kind of nice to have those options built into the same controller.
Yeah, like Mega Man, for example, if you're just using your regular weapon, you probably want to use Turbo Fire on that old pea shooter arm cannon. and then you'd use turbo. But if you want to use a special weapon that has limited ammo, then there's a good chance you wouldn't want to do that. And so you can just, you know, easily move your finger or your thumb back and forth between those buttons, depending on what your need is.
Yeah, this was also the first, like, really ergonomic controller that Nintendo made, if you think about it.
Yeah, I guess you could think of it that way.
You know, the form factor came years later, but, you know, back in the day, the NES controller was a brick.
Yep, and it's a rectangle. It worked pretty well, though.
And this one kind of has the same shape as, you know, controllers for years to come, so.
Yeah, it's sort of got grips on the sides.
Yep. Now, what about that slider? Did you use that much?
Somewhat. You're talking about that weird red circular slide pad. They call it a cyclode, I think. And that's what they had instead of the traditional control pad. And when I first got my NES Max, I tried using it, and it was a real pain in the butt. Like, a lot of the times, it wouldn't even register.
Yeah.
Like, I thought it would be really great for a lot of games, but, you know, kind of gave me issues. And so I ended up just, you know, pressing the direction on the black rim instead. And until I discovered that, I was like kind of horrified. I'm like, oh man, this is going to be really hard to use. But, you know, by pressing on the black edge, it actually ended up being really convenient and useful.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember doing that same thing. Like, you know, occasionally you use the slider, but the black rim kind of ended up being the de facto way to use it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it's definitely way further for your thumb to move around the stick or the control pad, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
But it also felt in some ways more precise because you were actively hitting up or down or left or right. There really wasn't in between like there could be on the control pad.
I suppose that's true. A lot less chance of error. But the weird thing about it was that, in theory, it gave you 360 degrees of movement, but this was before analog control, so it was sort of held back by the system only supporting traditional digital control.
Yeah, it's almost what you see on the 3DS with the little slide analog stick.
I mean, it's very similar, except it didn't automatically come back to center, and as we've been mentioning, it didn't always work properly. However, I will say that second NES Max I got all those years later, the Cyclode actually works perfectly, and it works great. Like, one of the things that I thought was a natural fit for the Cycloid was in Track and Field 2, where you perform the hammer throw by spinning the directional pad 360 degrees. And with my first Max, I just couldn't do it at all. But my second one worked beautifully, and by using the Cycloid, I could easily achieve, like, record-setting distances in that event. I was like, wow, if my original one worked this well all those years ago, I probably would have used this every time I played my NES growing up. Yeah, I guess it was just sort of a hit or miss in manufacturing or something. But still, despite that, I absolutely love this controller. If Nintendo wanted to bring this thing back and make it available as a peripheral, you know, compatible with the NES Classic, I would totally buy it all over again.
Yeah, that's funny. I was just thinking about that. I think I would too.
Okay, the next peripheral I want to bring up is you know, one of the ones that people, I'm sure, remember the most, the NES Zapper.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, this being the classic light gun that you could use to try to shoot the dog in Duck Hunt. I mean, that was its main use, right?
Yeah. No, I think it's wildly funny that it was called the Zapper because, you know, the last thing Nintendo wanted to do was have a gun. And so you know that that name in general was like a conscious effort to make it sound almost like nothing. Oh, you got a zapper over there. But, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was 100% a Nintendo pistol.
Well, not like in Japan, where it actually was literally shaped like a pistol. You know, over here, at least, it was some sort of, you know, futuristic ray gun kind of thing. But, you know, that didn't stop them from, you know, changing the initial gray color to orange over the years, so you would definitely not mistake it for any kind of gun.
Yeah, that's right. Did you use this thing much when you were growing up there, Chris?
Well, obviously, you know, Duck Hunt came with a system.
Yep.
And so I played that a whole bunch. But, you know, I didn't really have a lot of other Zapper games. I didn't own Hogan's Alley or Wild Gunman, and the Zapper stages were probably the best part of Bayou Billy. But I admit it isn't something I used a ton. Still, it's so iconic that I definitely call it one of the best accessories for the NES. I think I did play a lot of Gumshoe, though, even though owned that game.
Did we just become good friends, Chris? Because Gumshoe is one of my favorites of all time.
Really? Really?
Well, for weird reasons. I think it's mainly just because it's like one of the few Nintendo games with a story that has never been rebooted. I mean, it had a compelling story.
Well, it's a game about, you know, detective. I think he's trying to rescue his daughter. Is that what it is?
Yeah, in fact, I think that would actually be a candidate for your dramatic readings.
Yeah, sorry to disappoint you, but we actually already did that one as a dramatic reading, all the way back around episode 50 or 48 or something like that. Yep, already beat you to the punch on that one. Sorry.
I might have to go back and read that, or listen to that, rather.
I guess so. But yeah, it was definitely a weird and unique game in that you actually shot the character to keep him in the air.
That's right.
That was very, very bizarre. And just, you know, all this stuff coming at you. It was very different from all the other light gun games out there. It definitely made it interesting.
I could not beat this game to save my life, by the way. Sorry.
It was really, really tough.
Now, did you cheat and hold it right next to the screen, or did you play back a ways?
Oh, I would generally try to stand back a ways, but, you know, if things got really tough, I might be tempted to get really close and see what would happen.
Yeah, it was always kind of fun to see how far you could get in Duck Hunt when you were right next to the screen.
Yeah, I think once it got, like, ridiculously fast, I would start getting really close and try to pull some shenanigans, but it didn't necessarily help.
You know, in a way, I feel like the Zapper was maybe, in some weird way, the precursor to the Wii Remote, in the sense that when you watch somebody play a game with the Zapper, it was compelling. You get to see, as imagine parents watching their kids play with a Zapper, you'd actually see them doing something as opposed to Mario, where they're literally just sitting there staring at the television.
Hmm.
I think there is something compelling about that, and I do think that Nintendo used that same sort of logic to get people to, you know, interact with their TV all over again in the Wii era. But
yeah, I suppose that's one way to look at it.
Kind of had its roots maybe with the Zapper.
Perhaps so. Another nifty peripheral available for the system was the 4Score, as well as the NES Satellite, both of which were 4-player adapters for the NES. Now, I don't know why Nintendo made 2 4-player adapters. The 4Score was corded and the Satellite was wireless, and I admit maybe it was better in theory than in practice, but back before the N64 systems couldn't handle more than 2 players without an adapter, so this was pretty cool to have, even if there weren't that many games that took advantage of it.
Right. I mean, what were the games that you could play 4-player? Do you have a list?
Well, there was 1 4-player game that I really, really did like playing in 4-player mode, and that was Gauntlet 2.
Oh, right. Of course.
Because Gauntlet in the arcade was a 4-player game, but Gauntlet 1 was only 2 players. So then, to see them actually make a 4-player version of Gauntlet 2 on the NES was pretty darn cool. So for that alone, I think the 4Score and the Satellite deserve a place on the list. There was also, from what I understand, a pretty good multiplayer version of Bomberman 2 that came out, but that was released really late in the NES's life cycle. But beyond that, you know, I don't really know. I mean, there was a 4-player football game. I believe NES Play Action Football was 4 players, but I wasn't a big football
yep.
fan, so I didn't really play that game. I believe that the NES adaptation of A Nightmare on Elm Street was a 4-player game.
Yep, that's correct.
And like most LJN games, it was terrible. So having 1 player or 2 players or 4 players didn't really make a whole lot of difference. Yeah, I mean, Nintendo was really pushing this at the time. I remember, you know, Nintendo Power even had a full issue dedicated just to 4-player multiplayer games back then, but they didn't really have a great first-party marquee title to really hang their hat on.
No, there really wasn't.
But despite that, you know, like I said, there were some very fun experiences. And being able to have, you know, 4 players going at it once, like you could in the arcade in the case of Gauntlet 2, did make it, you know, pretty cool if you were a fan of that particular title.
Yeah, another arcade translation was Smash TV. That actually used 4-player as well, but I don't remember that being very good on NES.
Well, kind of. The thing is, it wasn't actually a 4-player game, but you could hook up 4 controllers to it, and because it was a twin-stick shooter, you could hold an NES controller in each hand.
Oh, that's right.
And then using your thumbs, you would move with the NES controller in your left hand and shoot
wow.
using the control pad in, you know, 8 directions with the controller in your right hand, which, you know, probably was a better...
I'm not even sure how I feel about that.
Yeah, it was pretty awkward. It was probably a better option than trying to do it with just 2 buttons, like you would with just a single controller. But then again, you're better off just buying a Super NES and playing with a Super NES controller and getting a much more authentic experience in that case. But yeah, that was certainly an interesting experiment. That's for sure.
Chris, one peripheral that kind of stands out in my mind amongst, you know, the heap.
Oh, yeah?
Is the Game Genie.
The Game Genie. Oh, my.
Yeah. Do you remember that? Did you ever
own
that? I've
not heard that name in a long, long time. Oh, we don't talk about that. That's an unlicensed peripheral. How dare you speak of such things?
I know. I heard you're a Game Genie in a bottle.
I cannot confirm nor deny that, but try rubbing me and see what happens. Obviously, this is something we never would have gotten away talking about at Nintendo Power because it was unlicensed. But truth be told, it was a pretty darn cool device. For those who aren't aware, it was this little cartridge that you would plug onto the end of any NES game pack, and then you'd plug that into the NES.
Mm-hmm. Very forcefully, I might add.
And then this password screen would appear, and you could enter these cheat codes, and they will let you do all kinds of ridiculous things in the games, usually, you know, making you invincible or giving you infinite lives or letting you start on the last level or, you know, things of that nature. So if you wanted to beat a game and you didn't care how you did it, picking up a Game Genie was the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty revolutionary device for its time.
It was.
Just the fact that you could, you know, alter your game. I mean, if you went over to a friend's house and you saw that somebody was just playing Contra with just endless lives, you got a little jealous. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I mean, I did pick up one of these things because, you know, the idea of being able to just do weird and crazy things in these games really appealed to me. And, you know, Nintendo tried to stop it. Nintendo, you know, issued a court order that prevented it from being released in the United States initially. But that got overturned. You know, Nintendo, you know, they don't lose in court a lot, but they did in this case.
Yeah.
And so it did end up coming out over here. And, you know, like I said, most of the time you use it to, you know, just totally cheat your brains out. But you know, you plug in like Super Mario Brothers to this thing, you could enter almost any code and it would just give you like some totally weird random level that was just, you know, generated out of nothing. You'd be like, here's the underwater level with yellow and red mushrooms, and here's a bunch of Bowsers are floating around. Can you get to the end?
That's really funny.
I mean, most games, if you just put in random nonsense, you know, there'd be no effect, or, you know, might even, you know, cause your game to hang up on you. But with Super Mario, you could enter almost any code, and it would be guaranteed to give you something kind of ridiculous.
That's funny. It's almost like Mario Maker before before Mario Maker.
Yes, it's like random Mario Maker. It totally is. And I'll admit, there are a couple games that I was never able to beat without using a Game Genie. To this day, it is to my great shame that I've still never beat Iron Sword without using a Game Genie. Got to the final boss and just could never beat it. So, you know, one time I used a Game Genie, like, okay, well, now I've finally seen the ending. I'd like to do this legit one day, but it has not happened yet.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, there were some NES games that were beyond difficult. Like,
yeah,
once you died, that was it. Like, you didn't get to continue or not necessarily.
Yep, so, true.
Gotta say, Game Genie saved some lives.
Probably saved some broken controllers, too.
Yeah, definitely. They also had a great marketing campaign behind this. Do you remember that at all?
Can't say that I do.
If I remember right, they had a pretty radical TV commercial.
Oh, yeah. It had like these cheesy Bill and Ted knockoffs, didn't it?
All I know is brought to you by Galoob.
Yep, those are the guys who gave it to us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I believe Codemasters was actually the company that originally created it. But yeah, Galoob was the distributor in North America.
Now, there's a rumor you're going to name your firstborn child Galoob. Is that accurate?
No, I've already promised to name him or her Chrono.
Oh, wow. Is that a real thing?
I'm not telling.
All right, moving on.
Yes, moving on to our next NES peripheral of note. How could we have this discussion without bringing up Rob, the robotic operating buddy?
Oh, of course.
Rob, of course, was one of the most iconic parts of the NES package. He was sold with some variations of the system. Was it actually any good or not, though? You know, in that context, I don't know if he belongs on the best part of our list or the worst part of our list. I mean, he looked really cool. The idea of, you know, playing a video game with a robot, you know, that sounds pretty darn awesome when you're a kid. Unfortunately, it only worked with a couple of games, and those games weren't very good, and it didn't work very well, and it tended to break a whole lot. So,
Yeah, I mean, of course, most folks probably know him now from, Smash Brothers,
Yeah, and Mario Kart.
and he's shown up in an amiibo form.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, it was essentially this little robot that kind of had a likeness to Johnny Five from the Short Circuit series.
Yeah, that's true.
And yeah, as you mentioned, yeah, he's this sort of like, the way I've heard it described is sort of a Trojan horse.
Right.
At the time, Nintendo was desperate to get their system, their console, the NES, into stores, and a lot of stores didn't want to carry a video game system. Atari had kind of ruined the market.
Yeah, there was the huge video game crash of 1980, whatever.
Right.
And so Nintendo's like, oh, well, ours isn't a video game system so much because we've got a cool robot in there. And apparently the stores are like, robot?
Right, and it's an entertainment system.
Yeah, exactly.
So, in a lot of ways, Chris, as you mentioned, it's a terrible peripheral, and it probably belongs on the worst side of things. However, if he never existed, there's a chance that we would never have played the NES, or at least certainly
Yes.
not to the level of ownership that existed back then. So, I think we do owe a lot to Rob.
Yeah, absolutely.
He sort of died so we could live.
I don't know if I'd put it that way, but yes, Nintendo might not be where it is today if it were not for Rob. Even if his games were crappy, you got to give a shout out to the robotic operating buddy.
Now, have you ever played Gyromite or Stack Up?
I've definitely played Gyromite, but I didn't really play it much with Rob because,
Yeah.
he's supposed to pick up these gyros and move them
Oh.
around, and he's not very good at it. He was kind of, I think the one I was using was broken, and so he couldn't really
Yeah.
do what he was supposed to do.
I think they were all broken.
Yeah, so it seems. So most of the times I would just play it in two-player mode, and my friend would just, purposely crush the professor with a pylon, after like two levels, so.
Now, Gyromite was actually part of the deluxe set package,
Yeah.
whereas Stack Up was sold separately. And the only time, do you know the only time I ever actually saw Stack Up even in person, like the box and the game itself?
No, I wouldn't.
It was actually Nintendo Power's own Andy Myers who brought it into the office, and that was literally the first time I'd ever even seen that game in operation. It was so rare.
Yeah, it definitely is one of the most rare NES games out there. Hard to come by. Yeah,
Yeah.
by the time I got into the system, it probably wasn't even available anymore. All right, so coming off of Rob, we are definitely now moving into the worst part of our NES peripherals list. And when we're talking about worst peripherals, obviously you gotta talk about the Power Glove.
Don't want to hate the Power Glove, but I can't love
It's just so bad, man.
it's so bad.
That's what they said in the movie. It's so bad. And they were righter than they knew.
Yeah, I mean, you're referring to the wizard, right?
Yes, I am. And they showed in that movie how cool it was and how great it was to, put this glove on and move around your fist and you could do all kinds of great stuff. In reality, it didn't work that way at all.
It really didn't.
Yeah, it was awful and how these, pre-programmed routines you could try to use, but no matter what you did, it just never worked like it was supposed to. And you said earlier that the Zapper was sort of a precursor to the Wii Remote, but I feel like something like the Power Glove was even more of a precursor to the Wii Remote because, it was supposed to follow your hand gestures. You were supposed to move around your hand, your character would move on screen. In theory, sounds great. In practice, it was awful.
Yeah.
Hold down different fingers for, turbo moves. And, it sounds especially great for punch-up because you're punching people. You got a glove on. No, it just nothing about it worked right. So it was a pretty miserable experience.
Yeah, if you were going by looks alone, the Power Glove was probably a 10 at that point in time. But
Yeah.
if you actually went on functionality, it was probably like a 4 or 3.
Yeah, it was just not very good. Although, one great thing about the Power Glove is that it did give us a fantastic video. Look it up on YouTube of former Nintendo Power Editor-in-Chief Chris Slate pimping the Power Glove. It's out there. Find it. But along those same lines as the Power Glove, there was also the U-Force, which was released around the same time.
Oh, man.
And, I did use the Power Glove. I borrowed it and, you know, tried it out and brought it home and tested it out. And I tried to play Mario. And I tried to play Punch-Out. And I tried to play Top Gun, just like it advertised. And it was horrible. I don't know if I ever actually used the U-Force. But
yeah, I can say I never did.
It was also kind of the same thing. You had this little screen set up, and it was supposed to, again, read your motions, and you'd be able to play games that way. But, you know, whereas at least the Power Glove went on to fame and glory as a movie star, no one ever really talked about the U-Force.
Yeah.
It just faded away into obscurity, and apparently, you know, from everything I heard, just, you know, was not even worth, you know, hooking up and trying out. But again, helped pave the way for ideas that were, you know, showing up in products like the Wii.
They had the best tagline on the box, though. You touch nothing, yet it knows your every move.
I'd kind of forgotten about that. Pretty awesome.
It's pretty awesome.
Now, what about the Power Pad? Did you have a Power Pad?
You know, I never owned a Power Pad, but my neighbors did, and I spent many a day trying to outrun somebody in track and field, and of course, inevitably, it would break down to people cheating and just using their hands.
Just sit down and just pound the buttons with alternating hands?
Yep.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Because it was always faster than using your feet, because you could gravity was sort of against you when you did that.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of this thing was it was like this big mat, and it had, like, how many buttons on there? 12 or 16 or something. And
Oh, boy.
You would then be able to play the game by, you know, pressing the buttons with your feet. And again, this is another idea that isn't terrible, but it was just before its time. Like, if they had come out with, you know, Dance Dance Revolution back then on the NES, right, then this thing would have sold like wildfire.
Yeah.
But, of course, they didn't have any good games for it. They just had world-class track meet and stadium games and probably a couple more I'm not remembering right now. And so it was basically just a fitness peripheral.
Yeah.
Which, you know, gamers at that time didn't really want. Again, it's probably a precursor to the Wii Balance Board, which again sold like hotcakes. So, you know, it's amazing how we can see all of these things and see how they actually worked out in a much better form all these years later. But back then, not so much.
Yeah. And, you know, this actually, this peripheral sort of later replaced Rob and became a set called the Power Set.
Yes. Yes, it did.
Yeah, in which you got the NES, two controllers, a zapper, the Power Pad, and a game that had Super Mario Brothers, Duck Hunt, and World Class Track Meet all on the same
right.
cartridge.
Very true.
Which was quite a promise, and honestly, probably a better bundle than the Rob bundle. More value.
I guess, but these days, you know, if I were to say, boy, I wish I had one of these still sitting around in my parents' attic or something, I would definitely rather have a somewhat junky robot than the old Power Pad, which you know doesn't even look retro cool or anything, just be folded up in a box somewhere. So
you're a somewhat junky robot.
How dare you. Well, speaking of things that are somewhat junky, though, that brings us to the last peripheral I wanted to talk about that's on this list, and that is the Rock and Roller from LJN. Are you familiar with this thing?
I have seen it, never used it.
Well, you know, if you thought the Power Pad was exciting, then you'll really like the Rock and Roller. I don't know. It just seemed like a bad idea. I mean, at least the Power Pad was designed to play, you know, some specific games, so there was sort of maybe some merit to that. But the Rock and Roller was just this weird, awkwardly shaped sort of ball-like controller, and you were just supposed to move your character by stepping on the sides of it with your feet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just try to imagine playing Super Mario Brothers or Legend of Zelda or Castlevania or something with your feet.
No.
Now, there's probably some sort of, you know, amazing video out there or some world record person who can do amazing things with this controller. But for your average person, it was just the most ridiculous thing. Just an utter piece of junk.
Yeah, just looking at pictures of it makes me kind of angry.
And, you know, it was from the fine folks at LJN, makers of awesome licensed games such as Friday the 13th mm-hmm. and Back to the Future.
Yeah, it's true.
So, you know, with a pedigree like that, how could you go wrong? Well, it was almost inevitable.
You know, it's sad to think that somebody probably got really injured using this thing.
It wouldn't surprise me.
I mean,
it doesn't seem like something you should be standing on.
No. It literally is one of those like balance boards you can buy, you know, at like a yoga shop or something. And it's so weird that was like a thing that is like, that doesn't sound like a good idea to just be on this thing that doesn't have a like a resting position. But, to each their own.
Yeah, that was not a good idea. NES Advantage, NES Max, Zapper, all great stuff. Power Glove, U-Force, Rock and Roller, definitely not.
I agree with you on all of those.
Well, that does it for our trip down NES peripheral memory lane. Obviously, there were a lot more peripherals than that for the system, but I think this covers certainly the highs and the lows that you could get on the old 8-bit NES.
Agreed.
And with that said, I think that brings this big topic to a close, and that means it's time to wrap up this episode. Although, before we go, I do believe we have time for one more thing, and I believe you know what that is.
What is that, Chris?
That is a dramatic reading. Once again, continuing the adventures of Captain Nintendo. Previously, Nintendo employee Brett Randles paused his Metroid game and was caught in an explosion that gave him special powers and also caused Mother Brain and Ganon to come to life. After receiving a drawn-out pep talk from his co-worker Terra, Brett prepared for battle when Ganon suddenly disappeared. And now, the saga continues. What? Thought Captain? Where'd he? Oof! Something unseen had knocked Captain Nintendo several feet across the floor and onto his costumed keister. He was so shocked, he didn't even hear Terra, who by this time was trying to administer first aid to his unconscious best pal Max, scream his name. Though considerably dazed, he could sense that Ganon was coming toward him. Instinctively, Captain Nintendo bathed the area in different hues, hoping to change the light pattern around Ganon and make him visible. Going through the spectrum had little effect until Captain hit upon ultraviolet rays. He could just make out a huge form plodding toward him. He then increased the intensity of the rays, casting a dim, silverish wash over the entire reception area. "Ariarg!" Ganon roared in pain and promptly became visible, waving his ape-like arms and glaring with crazed fury. Cap wasted no time. Though weakened by the blow from Ganon, Cap focused a concentrated beam of solid silver laser light and hit the towering beast full force right between the eyes. "Aruarg! Ruarg!" Ganon was definitely ticked off. He put his paws to his smoldering eyes, stumbled back, and plopped onto his own keister with a considerable thud. He continued to snarl and complain unintelligibly. Captain Nintendo noticed that the Mother Brain was quivering somewhat. He realized that the Mother Brain was directly controlling Ganon.
Wow,
indeed. Lots of talks about keisters in this edition of Captain Nintendo.
Yeah, keisters.
Yes. So we found out that Mother Brain is controlling Ganon. I guess we'll have to see what the repercussions of that mean when we continue this in an upcoming episode.
You and those death sounds, those were something else.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Normally I charge good money for that.
Those might have to be a special guest on another episode.
Yeah, I'll see what I can do. Speaking of dramatic readings, let's not forget that you, Pete, recently put out the call for Hoff vs. Pete fanfics to be read in an upcoming episode. We haven't received too many submissions yet, so if you're really bored and want to help bring Pete's weird beard fantasies to life, you've still got time. Anyway, that does it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at PowerProsPod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can follow me, The Hoff, on Twitter at Chris The Hoff, and you can find Pete at Burly Red Yeti. You can email us at powerprospod@gmail.com, and of course, if you like the podcast, it would be great if you would give us a rating on iTunes. Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Pete Michaud.
It's so bad.
and our resident weapons expert, Paco Loco.
Hasta la, bye bye.
We will see you next time.